Well, I remember not that long ago chatting to Alistair, and we talked about passages that we shouldn't, a minister shouldn't preach on. Not that there are things in the Bible that shouldn't be preached on, but things that perhaps you should get a visitor to preach on or someone else in the congregation to preach on, and this passage was the main candidate. But I've given it myself it to preach. Well, perhaps as an oversight, I can't remember what I was thinking. So at the start, any comment that you think is pointed isn't meant to be, although, as I've said before to people, if the hat fits. But it's not sort of a covert message of how you should treat me better or something like that. But rather, what I'm trying to do is get a sort of big flow of how sort of things flow through this book as a whole. We've been doing a series on 1 Timothy. And the point of doing 1 Timothy really is to help us understand the nature of the church and really what how a healthy church should work and what people's roles are and so on. And some of you are moving on this summer, and hopefully it's useful for all of us, but hopefully for you, this is helpful as you search for another church when you move. 1 Timothy is a letter from Paul to Timothy, who's a key leader in Ephesus, and the Ephesian church has got some serious problems. There are false teaching going on and false teachers there, and this false teaching is leading to all sorts of wrong behaviour as well. Interestingly, a lot of the detail we're not told. We just know that that's a problem. And a key note through the book, in fact through all what we call the pastoral epistles, is that doctrine and behaviour have to match in the right way. Or rather, I suppose you could say they do match. Bad doctrine leads to bad behaviour and so on. So these issues are for the whole church, but often what we've noticed in 1 Timothy is often things boil down to the leaders, especially the overseers and elders, as they're called. And it seems that the problems have started with them, and any solution is going to start with them as well. So we've seen already the qualifications for overseers and deacons. We've said something about the role of overseers, and now something about how the church relates to them. So we don't know exactly what the fallout of these issues were, but you can see, you can imagine some of the issues that would have affected by what goes on. One of the issues would have been, how do you think of elders? How do you respect them? How do you accuse them? And how do you select them? And they're the three things we're going to be looking at. Respect, accusation, and selection. And as part of a larger section that we started to look at last week, starting at chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, I'll remind you of them. It says, "Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity." And then we thought last week about respect and honour for widows, a particular category of older women. This week we're thinking of a particular character, a particular group of older men, elders, and specific office holders amongst them. And then next week, we'll look at what we might say now is the workplace, treating people like brothers and sisters. So from last week, one thing we thought about, it's obvious when you think about it, but the church is a group of people. The church is a group of sinful people. If you put them together for any length of time, there will be conflict. And honour and respect is the oil that stops the engine seizing up. So three things just in the passage we're looking at this week, three things relating to elders, is one, honouring them, two, be slow to accuse them, and three, be slow to appoint them. So the first thing is to honour them in verses 17 to 18. Now remember, this honour and respect thing is meant to be from all in the church to all in the church. But some groups are mentioned specifically, because perhaps that under the circumstances you might not want to, or they might be easy to overlook. But look at verse 17. It says, "The elders who direct the affairs of the church, well, are worthy of double honour, especially those whose work is preaching and teaching." Now, why does that need saying? Because if we're meant to respect everyone, and elders are someone, why do we have to mention them? Well, it could be in the context of the book that the office has been brought into a poor reputation, so people need to be reminded that this is a God-given office. And it's already been stated in chapter 3, verse 1. It says, here is a trustworthy saying. If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, overseer and elder used interchangeably in the book, he desires a noble task. So I think this was really played down when I was considering ministry and selection. I rightly thought that all Christians have a part to play in the church, which they do, and the minister is a part. Someone's got to do it. So everyone is important, which is true. Everyone's equally important. That's true. Elders, and especially ministers, direct the church, which in 1 Timothy is called the household of God. And what they teach, how they behave, can torpedo or bless a church more directly and more quickly and more permanently than anyone else. They are to teach with authority in order to care and pastor the people that are entrusted to them. And at times that means correcting. The term sometimes it's used is discipline. It's a horrible term. The meaning is from a broader meaning, which means to disciple. So there's one sense in which right now you're under discipline because we're meeting together and at the table. When someone comes to visit you, you're under discipline. You're being discipled. You're being cared for. But also it does include, sadly, at times it will include some sort of other measure when things have gone wrong in someone's life. When they're sinning very directly and damagingly to the church. Elders have to direct that. And that's why I wish someone had warned me a bit more about that some time ago. And so here it says they're worthy because they direct affairs in the NIV. ESV says they rule. And the same word, it's in chapter 3, is translated manage. So you get the idea, rule, manage, direct. So you trust them to manage the people of God, to manage the affairs of the church. But it says here, especially those who teach. Now, there's two ways that this has been taken. One is that there are two kinds of elders, those who direct, often referred to as ruling elders, and those who teach. Guess what they're called? Teaching elders. But already in the book, we've had this word especially twice, in 4:10 and 5:8. And the sense is, particularly because. So Paul states a general thing and then it narrows it down. So God being the saviour of all men, especially those who believe, meaning all people can be saved when they have faith. So in that sense, you would say there's one kind of elder, however you take it. Notice that we're told that they're worthy of double honour. Now the word here is Tim-a, where you get the Tim in Timothy, whose letter is 2. Tim-a. It's Time Theos, God, honourer. And that word can mean respect or honour, and it can mean payment. And someone put it in one of the commentaries I was reading, is give them honour and honorarium. And the next verse goes on to talk about finance. And the way it does it, it's not very flattering to elders. In verse 18 it says, for the scripture says, do not muzzle the ox while it is treading out the grain, and the worker deserves his wages. Now how do you think of your minister? We don't have to answer. According to these verses, I'm either an unskilled labourer or an ox going round in circles. There's a degree of truth in those things, I guess. In 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about, makes two things clear about money and ministers. One, if you have a minister working full-time for the gospel, the church needs to share what it has, as it did in the with the priests in the Old Testament, as a matter of right. But equally, he's clear, the rights don't have to be taken, and Paul himself supplies for his own needs. He worked for blocks of time, saved, and then would work full-time on his savings. So the elders here in this church, we have two elders who work full-time in proper jobs. One works three-quarters of time here, quarter of time teaching Cubans, a slice of each week, but also in these blocks, and then I work full-time. I have no other skills with which to fall on. Now, I remember a number of years ago when I worked in the Church of England, the first church I worked in as an official employee in Southwark Diocese, lots of ministers in that diocese moaned about how much they were paid. Now, it turns out, I found out afterwards, Southwark Diocese is actually one of the higher paid dioceses. And the Bishop of Woolwich, the guy in charge of our patch, says, and he was quite a wise guy quite often, he said, not a wise guy, he was a wise man. He says, no, we pay you a stipend. We don't pay you a salary or a wage. What we're doing is not reflecting your worth, we're just excusing you from doing what the rest of your congregation do and going out and getting a job. So we're relieving you of work to focus on the church. We're not, it's nothing about your worth. And I thought that was quite helpful. Maybe someone had said something about this double honours. So, you know, the average wage in South London is X, so we should be paid 2X. And that would be biblical or something like that. And to be frank, a lot of the people that moaned wouldn't be earning more elsewhere because they wouldn't work hard enough and so on. And notice the condition here is that they labour. And the other condition is direct affairs well. So that there is a condition on this. Now, I have seen this breakdown. It hasn't broken down here, not in my time, if at all. And the breakdown happens when the minister says, I deserve. This is what I think I deserve. This is what I think I'm worth. And the church says, that will do. When the minister says something along the lines of, just keep me fed and dry, and the church says, we want to bless and honour you, everybody's happy. And I've noticed that the two tend to come together. Usually the church that tries to be positive has a positive minister, or is it the other way around? You can't quite tell. And when we both try and get our own way, neither's very happy. And I suppose that's because it's gospel-shaped. So one version is about mutual grace, and the other version is, what can we get, or what can we get away with? And at this particular church, the policy is, and it works this way through our presbytery, is that there's a benchmark that's aimed for, that's been worked out, and the idea is it's a stretch, but it's been achieved, and I'm very grateful when I'm paid. And it's no bad thing to then come and look at this and see there's actually a biblical rationale for why we do things the way we do. As an aside, notice two things about those Bible quotes in the footnotes. One is from Deuteronomy and one is from Luke. So by the time of 1 Timothy, Luke is viewed as part of the Bible. And also Deuteronomy still matters and applies. So the Bible identifies what is in the Bible and authenticates it. So that's the first thing, is the honour that is to go to elders. The second thing is to be slow to accuse in verses 19 to 21. Even if you're not into football, apologies for football illustrations, you'll have your fill of football this month. But you must notice how fast managers are hired and fired. And I always think the logic behind this is flawed, fundamentally. Because the logic goes like this. They're fired because they've not brought the best out of the players they have, and they've not bought the best players for their budget. So that logic means that you should fire the board for hiring them because they looked at the track record and so on and they've got the wrong guy. So fire them. And they never get time to make any change. And that's becoming the same in cricket and rugby too. And this is also seen, can be seen in the church. And what we've seen in chapter 1 is leaders that are familiar to the Ephesian church and to Timothy have been removed from office. And the elders were causing, certainly teachers, were causing problems in Ephesus. And extreme circumstances, something needs to happen about that, that ranges from a public rebuke to being removed from office. And of course, there's lots of things that happen in that process, from a quiet word to some more firm, wise advice to the whole thing going public. And in a dysfunctional church like that of Ephesus, the danger is that accusations are going to come too readily and too fast and too readily believed as well. And because of their leadership is a pivotal role and a role that's meant to be honoured, it needs to be slow to bring in accusation. Now, if it seems necessary, then there is a biblical procedure for it. And the process here sounds remarkably like that Jesus talks about in Matthew 18:15-18. So an accusation has to be worth it. There needs to be two or three witnesses, and if the accusation is proved true, there's some kind of appropriate measure, perhaps a public rebuke he mentions here. And through the process, verse 21, it is to be solemn, with no favoritism or partiality. And sadly, I've seen this go off both ends wrong. Accusation is too readily brought forward. Also, favoritism is shown so that it's not brought forward, which means people are accused who should not be, and people who should be accused aren't. The first, people accused who shouldn't be, often it comes out of revenge because of something else they're annoyed about. And the second, for various reasons, often has to do with fear of reputation. And actually, we can see that as a reasonable thing. Paul, throughout this letter, is concerned about the reputation of the church. So it's understandable why people wouldn't want to drag this up. But actually, if it is a serious thing, following Bible teaching keeps the reputation of the church. And that's why I think churches need to be connectional. I think there's other bits in the Bible that suggest that is the case. That means churches in close relation with other churches, where there's some kind of mutual authority, not a sort of top-down thing, but a mutual submission. That's also why I think we need more than one elder in a congregation. Doesn't mean to say you have to be Presbyterian, but this is a good way to put this stuff into practice. This is why we do things the way we do. So if there's a serious concern, then first you go to the elder concerned, get clarification, you may have misunderstood him, and then you go to the session with witnesses. If you really think we're not taking that seriously, and the issue is serious, then you go to the wider body, which in our case is our presbytery. And what this does is it prevents any accusation at a whim coming up, but it stops also elders sweeping things under the table. Elders are held accountable in one way, but also protected in the other. And these accusations are not minor annoyances, but matters of doctrine and lifestyle. Now, minor annoyances, I suppose what you have to do is consider what is the good of mentioning them or not. If it's good to mention, think how to do that, who to do that. And the motive always with these things is to build all the time. Now, most of us make mistakes in our jobs, and I always feel sorry when on the news you have doctors and nurses in court, because when they make mistakes, often the consequences are bigger than, oh, I'm sorry about that, let's just swap that round. If you've injected someone with the wrong thing, you can't just go, oh, sorry, let's just swap that. It's not quite as straightforward. Ministers and elders make mistakes. And when we do, let us say sorry for the fact we have, but too often mistakes are seized upon and blown out. And there's a difference, isn't there, between a mistake and deliberate ongoing sin. Serious doctrine and lifestyle issues have to be held to account. Now, if you think, oh, this is all a bit serious, all this stuff, do we have to talk about this? Giving elders or ministers a public rebuke. Think of the denominations that do not do this. There are many what were good reformed Protestant churches that ignore this. And what happens is over time, eventually false teaching, serious false teaching, is tolerated, and then eventually it becomes mainstream, to which traditional teaching is then tolerated. And then various groups either break out or new denominations start. Our denomination's relatively young. Someone starts a renewal group within the changing denomination. And often those groups end up worse than the thing that they left or are trying to reform. So this process has to be done, but it's not to be rushed. And there's a due process. So it makes you think, is this serious? Before people start throwing accusations around, is it serious? If it is, take a deep breath, pray, and do it through the due process. So the two problems are failure to discipline or overzealous, over-trigger-happy discipline. But that's not the only problem the church faces. The next one is that the third thing is to be slow to appoint in verses 22 to 25. When appointing new leaders, I think there are three things in these verses to look for. Take care, take time, and take wine. Take care, verse 22. Do not be hasty in laying on of hands, and do not share in the sins of others. Keep yourself pure. Now, the laying on of hands is what we sometimes talk of as ordination. That's what it means. We've seen a number of times in the Bible, but that is the end of the process. So the process is testing, training, testing for gifts and temperament, so that the individual and the church and the elders agree that this man is called by God. We ask, do you think you're called by God? And they can say with some degree of confidence that they are. And they're set apart, so everyone can see, by the elders laying on of hands. The idea is that they are identified and called and charged by God. And we're all saying that's what we think is happening. And it's quite possible, given the Ephesian problem, that they feel that some of these people were too hastily appointed. They've appointed men who showed good signs. Early on, they were gifted, and they've turned out to be false teachers. And if you remember, when we looked at Acts, the problem was, it says, from your own number. So he's addressing the elders and saying, you elders, from amongst you, there'll be false teachers. So give it be a bit careful. It could have been that, having removed some of these men from office for their false teaching, the Ephesian church, and especially Timothy, are eager to replace them. Imagine having your session be completely depleted because they've been disciplined over false teaching, and you're left with no elders or very few, or just one, you'd be very quick to start looking for where the replacements come from. And Paul's saying, no, don't repeat the problem. Take care. Why take care? We'll look at verse 22 again. When you lay hands on the man, you identify with him, and he with you. And that's part of the point, is this mutual identification between the elders. So it doesn't mean if the person who ordains you is goes off the rails, at least I hope he doesn't in my case, and if they, it doesn't mean they're not ordained or they've become unordained or accountable for their sins. And same if someone you ordain someone and they go off the rails, if due diligence is done. But if they've been hasty, if they've not been properly examined, then they bear part, the people who have selected them bear part of the responsibility for what they get up to and the damage that they do. And part of that diligence is the next thing, which is to take time in verses 24 to 25. Now, in most things in life, you can't always tell if you've made a good choice. When you buy a car, you really want to see how the car's going to do over the next 100,000 miles. There's lots of things that you think, I want to live out this choice for a bit and then go back on it when if I see that it's wrong. But we can't do that. When we identify someone for ordination, it should be the same. They may appear gifted, but we need to give them some time. So in verses 24 and 25, there's a contrast between sins and good deeds. Sins come in two forms, obvious sins and slow sins. The obvious you don't need to say very much about, because they're obvious, that you see them and they head towards judgment. But some sins follow slowly behind. They take time to emerge with their consequences. So things we might not have known about, but take a bit of time. Verse 25, good deeds are generally obvious, or will become obvious eventually. Jesus said, by their fruit you will know them. Well, if you're identifying by fruit, you need time for the fruit to ripen, so you can tell what the fruit is. And that's why we give people a hard time. If you ask our elders about that, we give them a bit of a grilling. So Hugo, the Cambridge wanted a new elder, and Hugo and I went up with some others to give him a bit of a grilling. And we give them scenarios about what they do if this happened in the church and how would they respond. Same with ministers. We also add with them some things they should be able to do or know. And he's not here this morning, but with Craig, it's he hasn't had the hard time meetings yet, where we always have these guys on the verge of tears. And there's a reason for that. Let's get the problems out early and tell them to think about it for a few more years or whatever. And most importantly, when we select these people, is we want to hear what their elders say about them and what their congregation says about them. Are they endorsing them, or are they warning us about them? So there's no rush when ordaining someone. It is best for them and in the church to be slow but sure. And the third thing is, take some wine. I say that slightly tongue-in-cheek, but look at verse 23. Stop drinking only water, but use a little wine because of your stomach and your frequent illness. Now, verse 23, when I was reading this, it just looks like a load of random things Paul's saying before he runs out of paper. And I'll take a bit of this. It seems all a bit out of sync. But I don't think it is at all. I think he drops this in here deliberately to make a point. The false teachers we've seen already are anti-creational. Wine is a good thing in creation, according to the Old Testament. Like marriage, which is another thing that they're teaching against. For them, all these things are unspiritual, and we're meant to rise above it. And Paul says, no, take a bit of wine. Wine is good. In fact, he says, take some for your stomach. A church a friend of mine went to, they were staunchly teetotal. It was a condition of membership. And they said, when you take them to this verse, they would say, to be applied externally. That would have to be very, very strong wine before it starts doing anything to your tummy. At university, I had a housemate who had stomach problems, IBS and various other things. And he was from, the doctor said to him, drink real ale, better still, Guinness. And my friend was very small in build and from a very strongly teetotal background. And he actually struggled to drink Guinness, but he found wine really helped his IBS. Wine really helped his stomach. So what's happening here with Timothy is that these conditions that he's in, these things like IBS and so on, are made far worse, everyone knows, by stress. And I imagine that Timothy was stressed. His church has got all this false teaching going on. What he's got to do, he's got to remember, he's got to not be quarrelsome. while setting an example to silence false teachers. I think that's stressful. He's got to refute them with respect. He's got to know the Bible well and prepare and teach it. He's got to identify and ordain new elders, but he's got to do that carefully and slowly. And possibly he's being accused of things along the way. He's being ignored because he's only 40. We know how young 40 is. And that's why he uses words like labour and an illustration of a cow treading the thing. This guy's under stress. And he's not saying take wine to de-stress you. That could be a problem as well. But the contrast is to the false teachers. We know that we are physical. We are physical beings. The body matters. So elders and pastors are just like everyone else. They have bodies and they need to care for their physical bodies. They need to sleep enough, take some time out, eat sensibly and deal with their stress. And they may take a little wine, but they do so in purity, with the right perspective and respect for what it is. And when laying hands on someone, I suppose that's another question. What kind of constitution do they have? I don't mean physical constitution, although that, I suppose that comes into it. But some people are too peachy. If they get ordained, they're going to get ulcers. And some, frankly, are not peachy enough. They're not sensitive enough to people around them. So last week we thought about respect for widows, and we saw a balance between compassion and discernment. And this week is about respect for elders, and the balance is accountability and care, or respect and accountability. They're not above the law. They're accountable, but they're to be cared for. Slow to accuse them, cautious who you choose, and make sure they're adequately cared for. And I think at CPC, from what I've seen anyway, is we're treading those lines pretty well. But we need to know those boundaries, because at some point, unfortunately, it's likely that they will be tried in some way. Someone will make an accusation, justified or not, and then that accusation will be dealt with correctly or not. At some point, a new elder will be suggested. We need to be ready so that they are tried and tested or not. And this isn't just about elders, but about you. Hebrews 13, the instructions about leaders, says about making their work a joy so that, and not a misery. And why? Because it would be no advantage to you if they're a misery guts. So waiting in the Bible is very much on elders and their role, but there's also a role for the congregation too, to bring the best out of them and them from each other as well. So these are specific instructions for a specific group, but they're based on that general principle that we apply to all. In chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, we respect everyone, we treat each other like a family, and that overcomes pretty much all friction. Let's pray together. Good deeds are obvious, even those that are not cannot be hidden. Father, we ask that as we look at these very specific teachings, you would help us to bear these things in mind so that we'd be increasingly the sort of church you want us to be. And also these general principles, that we would live out good deeds, that what we believe would affect what we behave in the right way, and that we would respect one another so that all friction in the church would be overcome. We ask this to bring you honour in this church. Amen.